Chapter 22. Lunar Thaumaturge Amory Park, Your Majesty. Kai and Torrin stood as the Thaumaturge glided past Nancy into Kai's office. Although Amory bowed respectfully to Kai as he came to stand on the opposite side of his desk, so low that the long sleeves of his maroon jacket nearly brushed the carpet, there was something supremely disrespectful in his air that always set Kai on edge. He had never quite been able to pinpoint what it was about this man. Maybe it was the way he always wore a faint smile at the corners of his lips. Or perhaps how that smile only reached his eyes when he was using his gift to manipulate someone. "Thank you for joining us," said Kai, gesturing to the chair across from him. "Please, make yourself comfortable."
"My pleasure," said Amory, settling gracefully into the offered chair. "Anything for Luna's future king."
The designation made Kai squirm. It was easy to forget that he would be taking on a new title as much as Lavanna was. But the difference was that Luna had very strict laws governing who could be put into positions of power, and Earthens certainly did not make the cut. He would be crowned King Consort, meaning he would be a pretty figurehead with virtually no power whatsoever. Unfortunately, the Commonwealth did not have the same fail-safes put in place. Kai's great-great-great-grandfather, the country's first emperor, must have trusted his descendants to make sound decisions on their spouses.
"I wanted to discuss with you a discovery recently made by the Earthen Union," Kai said, nodding at Torrin.
His advisor stepped closer to the desk and set a port screen in its center. With a click, the holograph of Earth, with 327 lunar spaceships surrounding it, flickered to life above the desk. Kai watched the Thaumaturge closely, but the man did not show an iota of a reaction to the holograph, even with hundreds of yellow dots reflected like fireflies in his dark eyes. "This is real-time imagery of Earth and its surrounding space," said Kai. "The markers have all been confirmed to be lunar spacecrafts." Amory's cheek seemed to twitch, as though he was on the verge of laughing, yet his voice remained as smooth as caramel when he spoke.
"It is a very striking picture indeed, Your Majesty. Thank you for sharing it with me."
Clenching his teeth, Kai lowered himself into his own chair. He was tempted to keep standing as a show of power, but he'd been around lunars enough to know that such mind games rarely had any effect. And at least when he was sitting, he could pretend to be comfortable. Pretend that he hadn't been dreading this conversation all day.
"You're very welcome," Kai deadpanned. "Now perhaps you can explain to me what they're all doing up there."
"Recreation,"
Amory leaned back, leisurely crossing his legs.
"We have many wealthy families on Luna who enjoy the occasional holiday cruise through our galaxy. I'm told it can be very relaxing."
Kai narrowed his eyes.
"And these holiday cruises routinely bring them within 10,000 kilometers of Earth,
where they remained anchored for days?"
"I am sure the view afforded them by such a location must be quite lovely."
One side of Amory's mouth quirked.
"Breathtaking sunrises, I'm told."
"Interesting, because all 327 of these ships bear the insignia of the Lunar Crown. It seems to me that these are actually Crown-sanctioned ships, either conducting some sort of surveillance on the Earthen Union, or preparing an attack should war be declared."
Amory's expression remained neutral.
"My mistake. Perhaps I should have said that we have many wealthy Crown-sanctioned families who enjoy the occasional holiday."
They held each other's gazes for a long moment, while the holographic oceans sparkled beneath the sun, while the white clouds swirled through the atmosphere.
"I don't know why Queen Lavanna has chosen to threaten us at this time and in this manner," Kai finally said, "but it is an unnecessary show of force, and one that trivializes all that we are attempting to accomplish with our peaceful negotiations. I want these ships to return to Luna within the next 24 hours.
And if Her Majesty refuses?
Kai's fingers twitched, but he forced them to relax. Then I cannot take responsibility for the actions of the rest of the Union. After the lunar attacks that occurred on the soil of all six Earthen countries, it would be within the jurisdiction of any one of my peers to meet this blatant threat of war with their own show of force.
Forgive me, Your Majesty. Did you not say before that these lunar ships had entered into the territorial boundaries of the Earthen Union? Surely, if Her Majesty was aware that we have intruded your legal atmosphere space, she would have them removed at once.
He leaned forward, showing a flash of white teeth.
You are insinuating that Luna has trespassed into your legal boundaries, aren't you?
This time, Kai couldn't keep his hands from curling into fists beneath the desk. At this time, they are outside the territorial boundaries. But that does not...
So you're saying Luna has committed no crime as laid out by the Union's own law?
Then how exactly would a show of force against these ships be warranted? We will not be bullied into accepting any more of your demands, said Kai. Her Majesty must know that she is already walking a very narrow tightrope. My patience is wearing thin, and the Union is tired of bowing to Lavanna's every whim, only to have her gratuitous displays of power thrown into our faces again and again.
Queen Lavanna has no more demands to make of you, said the Thaumaturge. The Commonwealth has been exceedingly accommodating to our requests, and I find it unfortunate that you see the presence of these thus far peaceful lunar ships as threatening.
If they aren't there to send us a message, then why are they there?
Amory shrugged. Perhaps they are waiting for the finalization of the peace alliance between Luna and the Commonwealth. After all, once Her Majesty has signed your Treaty of Bremen, peaceful travel between our two nations will be made possible, even encouraged. He smirked. And the Commonwealth really is so beautiful this time of year.
Kai's stomach writhed as the Thaumaturge uncrossed his legs and stood.
I trust that will be all, Your Majesty, he said, tucking his hands into his wide red sleeves. Unless you also wanted to discuss the approved symphony numbers to be played during the wedding feast.
Flushing, Kai pushed himself off his chair and turned off the holograph. This is not the end of this discussion.
Amory politely listed his head. If you insist, Your Majesty, I will inform my queen that you wish to discuss this matter with her in due course, though perhaps it would be prudent to wait until after the ceremony. As it is, she is quite distracted.
He bowed, and when he stood tall again, his face had taken on a taunting grin.
I will be sure to give my queen your love next I speak with her.
Kai was shaking with rage by the time Amory strode out of his office. How was it that Lunars didn't even have to use their mind powers, and they still drove him mad every time he talked to them? He had the sudden urge to throw something, but the port screen he was holding belonged to Torin, so he kindly passed it back to his advisor instead. Thanks for all your help, he muttered. Torin, who hadn't said a single word during the meeting, loosened his necktie.
You did not need my help, Your Majesty. I could not have argued your points any better than you did.
He sighed and clipped the port to his belt.
Unfortunately, Thaumaturge Park made all very sound points himself. In the eyes of intergalactic law, Luna has not yet committed a crime. At least, not in the case of these ships.
Maybe the intergalactic laws need to be revisited.
Perhaps, Your Majesty.
Kai collapsed back into his chair. Do you think he was just trying to get a rise out of me? Or are all those ships really going to invade the Commonwealth once the alliance is forged? Somehow, I just assumed Lavanna would be content to call herself Empress. I didn't think she'd want to bring her whole army here and let them make themselves right at home. Saying the words out loud made him flinch with how naive he sounded. Kai cursed beneath his breath. You know, I'm beginning to think I entered into this marriage thing a bit hastily.
You made the best decision you could at the time.
Kai rubbed his hands together, attempting to dispel the feeling of vulnerability that the Thaumaturge's presence had given him.
Torin, he said, sliding his eyes toward his advisor. If there was a way to avoid this marriage, and keep us from going to war, and get that antidote, you would agree that that would be the best course of action, wouldn't you?
Torin lowered himself slowly into the chair that the Thaumaturge had vacated.
I'm almost afraid to ask, Your Majesty.
Clearing his throat, Kai called for Nancy. A second later, her short, glossy white body appeared in the doorway. Nancy, have you found anything new? As she approached the desk, her sensor flashed once at him and once at Torin.
Permission clearance for Advisor Con Torin requested.
Torin's eyebrow jutted up, but Kai ignored it.
Clearance granted.
Nancy came to a stop beside the desk.
I've run a full report on Michelle Benoit, including a detailed timeline of her activities, occupations, achievements, and military service, and biographical information on 11 persons who seemed close enough to warrant attention. My data retrieval system is broadening the search to neighbors and potential acquaintances, beginning in the year 85 TE.
Who is Michelle Benoit?
Torin asked, in a tone that suggested he didn't really want to know the answer.
Michelle Benoit was born in 56 TE, said Nancy, and is noted most for her 28 years of service in the European Federation Armed Forces, 20 of which were served as wing commander. She received a Distinguished Service Medal for piloting the diplomatic mission to Luna in the year 85 TE. The mission included...
We think she may have something to do with Princess Celine, Kai interrupted, tapping some fast instructions into the built-in net screen on his desk. A moment later, a satellite photo of farmlands in southern France appeared across the screen. She owns this farm. He pointed to a dark spot where the ground had been recently scorched. And this field is where Cinder landed the first time she returned to Earth, right before the attack. So we assume that Cinder believes that Michelle Benoit is attached to the princess as well. Torin's face darkened, but he seemed to be withholding judgment until Kai finished.
I see.
Nancy, have you found anything useful? Useful is a subjective term relative to the actions that are taken prior to receiving information, and the resulting, Nancy, have you found anything relevant?
Relevant to what? Said Torin. What are you hoping to find?
Princess Celine. Torin sighed.
Again?
Yes, again, said Kai. He gestured toward the sky.
Aren't you the one who told me we had to try to stand up against Lavanna?
I didn't mean by chasing ghosts.
But think about it. She's the true heir to the lunar throne. You honestly don't think finding her would give us an advantage?
Torin's mouth pressed into a thin line, but to Kai's relief, he seemed to be considering the question.
I don't want you to be distracted from the things that are truly important.
Kai snorted. The important things, like jade centerpieces and whether my wedding sash should have flying bats or a pair of cranes embroidered on it? This isn't a joke. Clearly.
Rubbing his forehead, Torin eyed Nancy for a long moment, before casting his gaze toward the ceiling.
Your Majesty, according to Lynn Cinder's own warnings, Queen Lavanna already means to murder you because you were attempting to find the princess before. What will her retaliation be when she realizes you haven't stopped?
It doesn't matter. She already intends to kill me. So what else can she do? And Princess Celine would be the true heir. Her existence would negate any claim Lavanna has to her throne.
Torin dropped his shoulders.
And you think that by finding a girl who's, what, 15 years old?
16.
A 16-year-old girl. You believe that finding her is what the Commonwealth needs right now, more than anything else.
Kai gulped, but his answer was solid.
I do.
Torin settled back in his seat, resigned.
All right, fine. I won't try to dissuade you.
He eyed Nancy again, this time with distrust. As if this were all the android's fault.
Please, continue.
Nancy launched back into her report. Michelle Benoit disappeared from her farm on 11 August. Her identity chip was left in her home, having been removed from her wrist. Evidence did not indicate whether or not there had been a struggle. 2 weeks later, her granddaughter, Scarlett, who had lived with Benoit for 11 years, traveled from their home in Rio, France, to Paris. Tracking records indicate she was in Paris for 2 days before her identity chip went off the grid. Presumably, the chip was removed and destroyed. Timeline cross-examination indicates that her ID chip was last seen near an abandoned Paris opera house, at the same time that a nearby scan bank machine recorded what appears to be the landing and takeoff of a 214 Rampion. Satellite feeds, however, picked up no such spaceship at that location. Deductive reasoning leads me to believe that this was the ship on which Lynn Cinder is hiding, and that Scarlett Benoit may have boarded the ship at that time. Kai frowned and was glad when even Torin looked intrigued by this information.
Cinder made a special trip to Paris for this girl?
My logic aptitude suggests this is a possibility.
What else do we know about this, Scarlett?
According to her ID records, she came to live with Michelle Benoit in 115 TE, 2 years after the recorded death of Princess Celine. Her birth date indicates that she is 18 years old. However, there is no hospital record of Scarlett Benoit's birth, and her data was not input until she was 4 years old, so we cannot confirm the validity of any of her records.
You lost me.
Scarlett Benoit was not born in a hospital, neither was her father, Luc Raoul Benoit. Without official records, we must treat any information about their births as circumspect. It is possible that everything we know about Scarlett Benoit is false information.
Kai pressed his hands onto the desk. Are you saying there's a chance this girl, this Scarlett Benoit, is really Princess Celine?
It is a possibility that cannot be proved or disproved at this time, but I have found no evidence to warrant a dismissal of this hypothesis.
Kai filled his lungs, feeling that he hadn't taken a full breath in weeks. And Cinder knows it. Cinder figured it out. And now she has her. Cinder's found the princess.
Your Majesty, said Torin, you are jumping to some large conclusions.
But it makes sense, doesn't it?
Torin scowled. I will withhold my opinion on the matter until we have some information that is based on more than speculation.
Android speculation, Kai said, pointing at Nancy. It's better than regular speculation.
He pushed himself out of his chair and began to pace in front of the grand picture window. Princess Celine was alive. He just knew it. And Cinder had found her.
He almost laughed. I'm surprised to see you taking this all with such good humor, Your Majesty, said Torin. I would think you would be horrified by this turn of events.
Why? She's alive!
If this girl is the missing princess, then she is currently being held captive by a dangerous felon, Your Majesty.
What? Cinder's not dangerous.
Torin seemed unexpectedly furious as he, too, launched himself to his feet.
Have you forgotten that she's lunar? She is a lunar who had contacts working within this very palace. She coerced you, the most protected person in the country, into giving her a personal invitation to our annual ball, then infiltrated it with, I can only assume, the intention of provoking Queen Lavanna. She escaped from a high-security prison and has managed to evade capture by her entire military, which ultimately led to an attack that killed thousands of Earthens. How can you possibly say she isn't dangerous?
Kai straightened his spine.
Lavanna attacked us, not Cinder.
Groaning, Torin rubbed his fingers over his temples. It had been a long time since Kai had seen that expression on his advisor. The expression that indicated he thought Kai was a moron. Indignation flared inside him.
And for the record, she declined my invitation to the ball. She only came to warn me and Dr. Erland.
He hesitated. He still didn't know what to think about her relationship with Dr. Erland.
Lavanna wants her killed. I don't see that we've given her much choice other than to run.
Your Majesty, I worry that your feelings for this girl are causing a bias that could jeopardize your ability to make logical decisions where she's concerned.
Kai's face grew warm. Was he so transparent?
I'm still trying to find her, aren't I? I still have half the military out searching for her.
But are you trying to find her or this princess?
He gestured at Nancy.
If they're together, what does it matter? We can find them both.
And then you will give Luna a new queen and Lynn's Cinder will be pardoned?
I don't know. Maybe. Is that such a horrible thing to hope for?
She's still one of them. You said yourself that she lied to you about everything. What do you know about her?
She stole an ID chip out of a dead girl's wrist. She helped a known thief escape from prison. Do I need to go on?
Cringing, Kai spun back to face the window, crossing his arms stubbornly over his chest. He hated that every word Torin had said was indisputable, while every hope Nancy had given him was based on vague observations and hazy guesses.
I understand that you feel partially responsible for condemning her to execution,
Torin said, his tone growing gentler.
But you have to stop idolizing her.
Kai faced him again. I don't idolize her.
Torin gave him a speculative look until Kai began to grow uncomfortable.
I might admire her sometimes, but even you have to admit that it's pretty impressive what she's done. Plus, she stood up to Lavanna at the ball. You weren't impressed by that? Just a little?
Torin buttoned his suit jacket.
My point, Your Majesty, is that you seem to be putting an awful lot of faith in a girl you know virtually nothing about, and who has caused us all a great deal of trouble.
Kai scowled. Torin was right, of course. He didn't know anything about Cinder, no matter how much he felt that he did. But he was the Emperor. He had resources. He may not know much about Cinder, but if she could find out about the lost lunar princess, then he could find out more about her. And he knew just where to start looking.
Chapter 23. This time when Kress awoke, it was not sand engulfing her, although there was plenty of that, but arms. Thorn had pulled her against him so close that she could feel the rise and fall of his chest and his breath on the back of her neck. She groggily peeled her eyelids open. Night had fallen. The moon had returned, larger than the night before and surrounded by a sea of stars that winked and glittered at them. She was deathly thirsty and couldn't find any saliva to wet her parched tongue. She started to shiver, despite the layers of sheets and blankets and the parachute and the heat rising off her scorched skin. Despite Thorn's protective warmth. Teeth rattling, she nestled against him as much as she could, his embrace tightening around her. She looked up. The stars were moving, swirling over her head like a whirlpool trying to suck the whole planet into its depths. The stars were taunting her, laughing. She shut her eyes tight and was met with visions of Sybil's cruel smile. News headlines echoed in her head, spoken in a child's nasally voice.
14 cities attacked. Largest massacre in Third Era. 16,000 deaths.
Kress, wake up.
She jolted, still shaking. Thorn was hovering above her, his eyes bright with moonlight. He found her face, pressed his palm to her forehead, and cursed.
You're running a fever.
I'm cold.
He rubbed her arms.
I'm sorry, I know you're not going to like this, but we need to get up. We need to keep moving.
They were the cruelest words he could have said. She felt impossibly weak. Her whole body seemed to be made of sand that would blow apart with the slightest breeze.
Cress, are you still with me?
He cupped her cheeks in both hands. His skin was cool, soothing. I can't.
Her tongue stuck to the roof of her mouth when she spoke. Yes, you can. It will be better to walk at night when it's cool than to try and move during the day. You understand that, right?
My feet hurt, and I'm so dizzy.
Thorn grimaced.
She thought of stroking her fingers through his hair. In all the pictures she'd seen of him, even his jail pictures, he'd been so polished, so neat. But now, he was a wreck with whiskers on his chin and dirt in his hair. It did not make him any less handsome.
I know you don't want to keep going, he said. I know you deserve a rest, but if we just lie here, you might never get up.
She didn't think that sounded so awful. As the sand began to rock beneath her, she pressed her hand against his chest, seeking out the steadying heartbeat. She sighed happily when she found it. Her body began to dissolve, little grains of sand scattering. Captain, she murmured, I think I'm in love with you.
An eyebrow shot up. She counted 6 beats of his heart before, suddenly, he laughed. Don't tell me it took you 2 whole days to realize that. I must be losing my touch.
Her fingertips curled against him. You knew?
That you're lonely and I'm irresistible? Yeah, I knew. Come on, Cress, you're getting up.
Her head dropped into the sand, sleep threatening to take over. If he would just lie down beside her and take her into his arms, she would never have to get up again.
Cress, hey, no more sleeping. I need you. Remember the vultures? Cress, vultures.
You don't need me. You wouldn't be here at all if it weren't for me.
Not true. Well, only kind of true. We've already been over this.
She shuddered. Do you hate me?
Of course not, and you should stop wasting your energy talking about stupid things.
Scooping an arm beneath her shoulders, he forced her to sit up. She gripped his wrist. Do you think you could ever love me back?
Cress, this is sweet, but aren't I the first guy you've ever met? Come on, up you go.
She turned her head away, dread pressing down on her. He didn't believe her. He didn't understand how intensely she felt.
Oh, spades and aces and stars, he groaned. You're not crying again, are you?
No,
she bit her lip. It wasn't a lie. She certainly wanted to cry, but her eyes were all dried up.
Thorn pulled a hand through his hair, knocking away a cloud of sand.
Yes, he said firmly. We are obviously soulmates. Now please, stand up.
You've probably told lots of girls you loved them.
Well, yeah, but I would have reconsidered if I'd known you were going to hold it against me.
Misery washing over her, she crumpled against his side, her head spun. I'm dying, she murmured, struck by the certainty of it. I'm going to die, and I've never even been kissed.
Cress. Cress, you're not going to die.
We were going to have such a passionate romance, too, like in the dramas. But no, I'll die alone, never kissed. Not once.
He groaned, but it was out of frustration, not heartbreak. Listen, Cress, I hate to break this to you, but I am sweaty and itchy and haven't brushed my teeth in 2 days. This just isn't a good time for romance.
She squeaked and tucked her head between her knees, trying to get the world to stop turning so fast. The hopelessness of their situation was crushing her. The desert would never end. They would never get out. Thorn would never love her back.
Cress,
Look at me. Are you looking at me?
Mm-hmm,
she mumbled. Thorn hesitated. I don't believe you. Sighing, she pried her head up so she could peer at him through the curtain of chopped hair.
I'm looking at you.
He crouched close to her and felt for her face. I promise I will not let you die without being kissed.
I'm dying now.
You are not dying.
But
I will be the judge of when you are dying, and when that happens, I guarantee you will get a kiss worth waiting for. But right now, you have to get up.
She stared at him for a long moment. His eyes were surprisingly clear, almost like he could see her back, and he didn't flinch before her skeptical silence. He didn't grin nonchalantly or offer a teasing follow-up. He just waited. She couldn't help it when her attention drifted down to his mouth, and she felt something stir inside her. Resolve.
Do you promise?
He nodded.
I promise.
Shuddering at the pain that awaited her, she braced herself and put her hands out to him. The world tilted as he hoisted her up and she stumbled, but Thorn held her until she was steady. Hunger gnawed at her empty belly. Pain bit into her raw feet, shooting up through her legs and into her spine. Her whole face contorted, but she ignored it the best she could. With Thorn's help, she retied the sheet around her head.
Are your feet bleeding?
She could barely see them in the darkness, and they were still wrapped in the towels.
I don't know. They hurt a lot.
Your fever might be from an infection.
He handed her the last bottle of water, now half full.
Or you're dehydrated. Drink all of that.
She paused with the water bottle already tipped against her mouth, carefully, so as not to lose a single drop. It was a tempting offer. She could drink it all and still be thirsty, but...
All of it, said Thorn.
She drank until she could stop without her throat crying for more.
But what about you?
I've had my fill. She knew it wasn't true, but her tolerance for selflessness lessened with every gulp, and soon she'd done as he asked and drank it all. She stood wavering on her feet with the bottle turned up to the sky, hoping to capture another drop until she was sure there was nothing left. She swooned, longingly placing the empty bottle into the blanket sack on Thorn's shoulder. Peering up the horizon, she spotted the mountainous shadows still so far away. Thorn picked up his cane and she forced herself to take in 3 solid breaths before she started, hoping they would give her courage. She estimated the amount of steps it would take to reach the next sand dune and then began counting. 1 foot in front of the other. Warm air in, warm air out. The fantasy of being a brave explorer had long since dissipated, but she still clung to the knowledge that Thorn was relying on her. She plodded up the dune as her teeth began to chatter again. She stumbled twice. She tried to call up comforting daydreams, a soft bed, a worn blanket, sleeping in well past the sunrise in a softly lit room where flowers grew outside the windowsill. Waking up in Thorn's arms, his fingers stroking the hair off her brow, his lips pressing a good morning kiss against her temple. But she couldn't hold on to them. She had never known a room like that, and the hard-earned visions were too quickly overshadowed by pain. 1 dune came and went. She was already panting. 2 dunes. The mountains lingered tauntingly in the distance. Each time they topped one, she would focus on the next.
We'll just crest that hill, and then I'll sit for a minute. Just 1 more.
But instead of letting herself rest when the goal was reached, she chose another and kept going. Thorn didn't comment when she slipped and landed on her knees. He just picked her up and set her back on her feet. He said nothing when her pace slowed to a mere crawl, so long as they didn't stop. His presence was reassuring, never impatient, never harsh. After ages of delirious, mind-numbing progress through the sand, when she felt as though every limb were about to fall off, the sky to the east began to brighten.
and Cress realized that the landscape was changing. The sand dunes were becoming shorter and shallower, and, not far in the distance, they seemed to end in a long, flat plain of rocky red soil, dotted with scarce, prickly shrubs. Beyond that began the foothills of the mountains. She glanced at Thorn and was surprised to catch the evidence of exhaustion etched into his features, though he replaced it with steadfast determination as they came to a stop. She described the sight as well as she could.
"Can you guess how long it will take to reach those shrubs?"
she estimated, unable to bury the panic that it would turn out to be another illusion, and that the respite of sand and swells would flee farther away with every step they took.
"No," he nodded. "That's all right. We'll try to get to them before it gets too hot. We might be able to get some dew off their branches."
Dew. Water. Even just a lick. Just a taste. Never again would she snub a single muddy gulp. She started again, her legs screaming with the first few steps, until they began to numb again to the endless walking. Then, her eye snagged on something big and white, and she froze. Thorn crashed into her, and Cress would have collapsed if he hadn't wrapped his arms around her shoulders, steadying her.
"What's wrong?"
"There's an animal," she whispered, afraid to startle the creature that stood at the top of the dune. It had already seen them and was staring serenely at Cress. She tried to place it with what she knew of earthen wildlife. A goat of some sort? A gazelle? It had slender white legs atop enormous hooves and a rounded belly that showed the edges of ribs. Its calm face was tan, with swaths of black and white, like a mask around its eyes. Two towering spiral horns twisted up from its head, doubling its height. It was the first earthen animal she had ever seen, and it was beautiful and regal and mysterious, watching her with dark, unblinking eyes. For a moment, she imagined that she could speak to it with her mind, ask it to lead them to safety. It would recognize the goodness inside her and take pity, like an ancient animal goddess sent to guide her to her destiny.
"An animal?" Thorn said,
and she realized he'd been waiting for her to further explain what she was seeing. "It has long legs and horns and it's beautiful."
"Oh, good. We're back to this again."
She could hear the smile in his tone, but she dared not take her gaze from the creature, lest it dissolve into the air like a phantom.
"Could mean there's a water source nearby," Thorn mused. "We should keep going."
Cress took a tentative step forward. She felt the slip of sand more keenly than she had before, and recognized just how clumsy she and Thorn were, stumbling and scrambling over the dunes, while this creature stood so elegant and calm. The creature tilted its head, not moving as Cress inched closer. She didn't realize she was holding her breath until the beast's eyelids flickered, and it turned its head towards something on the other side of the dune. The crack of a gunshot rang out across the desert. Chapter 24. The creature balked and tumbled down the dune, blood dripping from the wound in its side. Cress cried out and fell backward. Thorn pulled her down into the sand. "Cress, are you all right?" She was shaking, watching as the animal fell and rolled the rest of the way, gathering clumps of sand on its hide. She wanted to scream, but any noise was paralyzed inside her, and she could think of nothing but that the animal had wanted to say something to her, and now the world was tilting and fading, and she was going to be sick, and there was blood in the sand, and she didn't know what happened, and "Cress! Cress!" Thorn's hands were on her, searching, and she realized dully that he thought she had been shot. She grabbed his wrists, holding them tight and trying to convey the truth through her grip when words wouldn't come to her.
I'm all...
She paused. They both heard it, panting, along with the slip and scramble of footsteps. Cress cowered, pressing into Thorn's embrace as terror washed over her. A man appeared at the top of the dune,
carrying a shotgun. He saw the animal first, dying or dead, but then spotted Crescent Thorn from the corner of his eye. He yelped, barely keeping his balance, and gaped at them. His eyebrows disappeared beneath a gauzy headdress. His brown eyes and the bridge of his nose were all she could see of his face. The rest of him, covered in a robe that draped nearly to his ankles, protected him from the harsh desert elements. Beneath the robe peeked a pair of denim pants and boots that had long been sun-bleached and caked with sand. He finished his own inspection of Crescent Thorn and lowered the gun. He began to speak, and for a moment, Cress thought that the sun and exhaustion had driven her mad after all. She didn't understand a word he said. Thorn's grip tightened on her arms. For a moment, the man stared at them in silence. Then he shifted, his eyebrows lowering and revealing flecks of gray in them.
"Universal, then,"
he said, in a thick accent that still made it a struggle to capture the words. He scanned their ragged clothes and sheets.
"You are not from here."
"Yes, sir," said Thorn, his voice rusty. "We need help. My wife and I were attacked and robbed 2 days ago. We have no more water. Please, can you help us?"
The man squinted.
"Your eyes."
Thorn's lips puckered. They'd been trying to hide his new disability, but his eyes still looked unfocused.
"The thieves gave me a good blow to the head," he said, "and my sight's been gone ever since, and my wife has a fever."
The man nodded.
"Of course. He stumbled over the language. "My friends are not far. There is an oasis near here. We have a camp."
Cress swooned. "An oasis? A camp?"
"I must bring the animal,"
the man said, tilting his head toward the fallen creature.
"Can you walk? Maybe 10 minutes.
Thorn rubbed Cress's arms.
"We can walk."
The 10 minutes seemed like an hour to Cress as they followed the man through the desert, treading in the wake carved out by the animal's carcass. Cress tried not to look at the poor beast, keeping her thoughts instead on the promise of safety. When she spotted the oasis, like paradise before them, a sudden burst of joy clawed up and out of her throat. They'd made it.
"Describe," Thorn murmured, gripping her elbow.
"There's a lake," she said, knowing that this one was real, and not sure how she ever could have confused that vague mirage with something so stark and vibrant.
"Blue as the sky, and surrounded by grasses and maybe a few dozen trees. Palm trees, I think. They're tall and skinny and..."
"The people, Cress. Describe the people."
"Oh," she counted. "I can see 7 people. I can't tell their genders from here. Everyone is wearing pale-colored robes over their heads, and there are, I think, camels tied up near the water. And there's a fire, and some people are setting out mats and tents. And there's so much shade."
The man with his kill stopped at the bottom of the slope.
"The man is waiting for us," Cress said.
Thorn bent near to her and placed a kiss against her cheek. Cress froze.
"Looks like we made it, Mrs. Smith."
As they got closer to the camp, the people stood. 2 members of the group walked out into the sand to greet them. Though they wore their cloaks over their heads, they'd pulled the covers down around their chins, and Cress could see that one of them was a woman. The hunter spoke to them in his other language, and a mixture of sympathy and curiosity entered the faces of these strangers, but not without a touch of suspicion. Though the woman's eyes were the sharpest of the group, she was the first to smile.
"What a trial you've been through," she said,
with an accent not quite as heavy as the hunter's.
"My name is Gina, and this is my husband, Niels. Welcome to our caravan. Come. We have plenty of food and water. Niels, assist the man with his bag."
Her husband came forward to take the makeshift sack off Thorn's shoulder. Though it had become lighter as their water had disappeared, Thorn's face was one of relief to have the weight gone.
"We have some food in there," he said. Preserved nutrition packs, mostly. It's not much, but it's yours, if you'll help us.
Thank you for the offer, said Gina. But this is not a negotiation, young man. We will help you.
Cress was grateful that no questions were asked as she and Thorn were led to the fire. The people shifted, eyeing them curiously as they made room on thickly woven mats. The hunter left them, dragging the animal's carcass to some other corner of the camp.
What kind of animal was that? Cress asked, eyes stuck to the path left by its body.
Desert Adax, said Niels, handing her and Thorn each a canteen full of water.
It was beautiful.
It will also be delicious. Now drink.
She wanted to mourn the animal, but the water was a blessed distraction. She dragged her attention to the canteen and did as she was told, drinking until her stomach ached from fullness. The people remained largely silent, and Cress felt the presence of their curiosity and stares closing in around her. She avoided meeting their eyes and unconsciously crept closer and closer against Thorn until he had no choice but to put an arm around her. We're deeply grateful to you, he said, offering an easy smile to no one in particular.
It was very lucky that you found us, or that Quende found you, said Gina. The desert is not a kind place. You must have a very lucky star.
Cress's lips tugged into a smile.
You're very young.
The words sounded accusatory to Cress's ears, but the woman's face was kind.
How long have you been married?
Newlyweds, said Thorn, giving Cress a squeeze. This was supposed to be our honeymoon. So much for that lucky star, I guess.
And I'm not as young as I look, Cress added,
feeling like she had to offer something to the act. But her voice squeaked, and she quickly regretted speaking.
Gina winked. You'll be grateful for that youthfulness someday.
Cress lowered her gaze again, and was glad when a wide spoon and a bowl of steaming food was set before her, smelling exotic and spicy and rich. She hesitated and risked a sideways glance at the woman who had handed it to her, not sure if she was supposed to share or pass it to the next person, or eat very slowly and delicately, or... But within moments, everyone around the fire was enjoying their own food with relish. Flushing with hunger, Cress pulled the bowl onto her lap. She nibbled slowly at first, trying to identify the earthen foods. Peas she easily recognized. They had those on Luna, too. But there were some other sort of vegetables that she didn't know, mixed with rice and covered in a thick, aromatic sauce. She scooped out a chunk of something yellowish and firm. She bit into it and discovered it was tender and steaming on the inside.
Don't they have potatoes where you come from?
Cress jerked her head up and saw Gina watching her curiously. She gulped.
This sauce, she said quietly, hoping Gina wouldn't notice her evading the question. Potatoes, of course.
Luna's potatoes were a darker color with a flakier texture.
What is it?
Just a simple curry. Do you like it?
She nodded enthusiastically.
Very much, thank you.
Realizing that all eyes had turned to her again, she hastily shoveled the rest of the potato into her mouth, though the spices were making her cheeks flush. As she ate, a plate of dried meats was passed to her. She did not ask from what animal. And then, a bowl filled with a juicy orange fruit and sweet, green-tinted nuts that were full of so many more flavors than the protein nuts Sybil had often brought for her.
Are you traders?
Thorn asked, accepting the handful of shelled nuts that Cress pressed into his palm.
We are, said Gina. We make this trek 4 times a year. I am upset by the threat of thieves. We haven't had such trouble in ages.
Desperate times, said Thorn with a shrug. If you don't mind my asking, why camels? It makes your way of life seem very second era.
Not at all. We make our living serving many of the smaller communities in the Sahara, many of which don't even have magnets on their own streets, much less on the trade routes between them.
Cress noticed Thorn's hand tightening around his bowl. The Sahara.
So, her stargazing had been correct. But his expression remained impassive, and she forced hers to do the same.
Why not use wheeled vehicles, then?
We do, occasionally, said one of the men, for special circumstances. But the desert does harsh things to machinery. They're not as reliable as the camels.
Gina took a few slices of the sticky sweet fruit and added it to the top of her curry.
This may not be a luxurious life, but we stay busy. Our towns rely on us.
Cress listened attentively, but kept her attention on the food. Now that they were safe, sheltered, and fed, she was developing a new fear, that at any moment, one of these men or women might look at her and see something different, something not quite earthen. Or that they would recognize Thorn, one of the most wanted fugitives on the planet. Whenever she dared to look up, she found their focus pinned on her and Thorn. She hunkered over her bowl of food, trying to fend off their prying eyes, and hoped that no one spoke to her. She became certain that any word she said would mark her as different, that simply by meeting their gazes, she would give herself away.
Not many tourists come through here, said Gina's husband, Niels. Any foreigners are usually just here for mining or archaeology. This side of the desert's been almost forgotten since the outbreak started.
We heard the outbreaks aren't half as bad as rumored, said Thorn, lying with an ease that astonished Cress.
You heard wrong. The plague outbreak is as bad as they think. Worse.
Which town were you traveling to? Asked Gina.
Oh, whichever one you're going to, Thorn said, not missing a beat. We don't want to burden you. We'll take our leave in any town with a net screen. You wouldn't happen to have any port screens on hand, would you?
We do, said the oldest woman, perhaps in her 50s. But net access is fickle here. We won't have a good connection until we get to Kufra.
Kufra? The next trading town, said Niels. It will take us another day to get there, but you should be able to find whatever you need.
We'll rest today and tonight and set out tomorrow, said Gina. You need to replenish yourself, and we want to avoid the high sun.
Thorn flashed a most grateful smile.
We can't thank you enough.
A bout of dizziness spun through Cress's head, forcing her to set down the bowl.
You don't look well,
someone said, she wasn't sure who.
My wife was feeling ill earlier.
You should have said. She could have heat sickness.
Gina stood, setting aside her food.
Come, you should not be so near the fire. You can use Quende's tent tonight, but you should drink more before you sleep. Jamal, bring me some damp blankets.
Cress accepted the hand that pulled her to her feet. She turned to Thorn and gathered her courage to give him a small, non-theatrical kiss on the cheek. But as soon as she bent toward him, blood rushed to her head. The world flipped over. White spots pricked at her eyesight, and she collapsed into the sand.
Chapter 25. Cinder pulled back the drapes and stepped into the shop, holding the curtain for Jason as she surveyed the shelves around her. Jars were filled with assorted herbs and liquids, many of them labeled in a language she didn't know, although, if she stared at them for too long, her netlink would begin searching for a translation. These exotic ingredients were scattered among boxes of drugs and bottles of pills that she recognized from pharmacies in the Commonwealth, along with bundles of gauze and bandages, pasty ointments, port screen accessories designed for taking various vital stats, massage oils, candles, and anatomical models. Flecks of dust caught on a few streams of light that filtered in from dirty windows, and a fan spun lazily in the corner, doing little to dispel the dry heat. In the corner, a holograph displayed the progression of internal bleeding due to a side injury, occasionally flickering. Jason meandered toward the back of the shop, still walking with a slight limp.
Hello? Cinder called.
Another curtain hung over a doorway on the far wall,
alongside an old mirror and a standing sink that was overgrown with a potted plant. The curtain swished, and a woman ducked through, pulling an apron over her plain jeans and a brightly patterned top.
"Coming! Coming!"
She spotted Cinder. Her eyes widened, followed by an enormous smile as she yanked the apron strings behind her.
"Welcome,"
she said in the thick accent that Cinder was becoming familiar with.
"Hi, thank you,"
Cinder set a port screen down on the counter between them, pulling up the list that Dr. Erland had recorded for her.
"I'm here for some supplies. I was told you would have these things." "Cinderlyn,"
she raised her head. The woman was still beaming.
"Yes?" "You are brave and beautiful."
She tensed, feeling more like the woman had threatened her than complimented her. In the moments following the unexpected statement, she waited for her lie detector to come on, but it never did. Brave, maybe. At least she could comprehend why someone would say that after they'd heard the stories about the ball. But beautiful? The woman kept smiling.
Thank you?
She nudged the port screen toward her. My friend gave me this list. The woman grabbed her hands and squeezed. Cinder gulped, surprised not only by the sudden touch, but at how the woman didn't flinch when she took her metal hand. Jason leaned over the counter and slid the port screen toward the woman so suddenly that she had to release Cinder's hand in order to catch it.
"We need these things," he said, pointing at the screen.
The woman's smile vanished as her gaze swept over Jason, who was wearing the shirt from his guard uniform, freshly cleaned and patched so that the bloodstains hardly showed on the maroon fabric.
"My son was also conscripted to become a guard for Lavanna."
Her eyes narrowed.
"But he was not so rude."
Jason shrugged.
"Some of us have things to do."
"Wait," said Cinder. "You're Lunar?" Her expression softened when she focused on Cinder again.
"Yes, like you."
She buried the discomfort that came with such an open admission.
"And your son is a royal guard?" "No, no, he chose to kill himself rather than become one of her puppets."
She flashed a glare at Jason and stood a little taller.
"Oh, I'm so sorry," said Cinder.
Jason rolled his eyes.
"I guess he must not have cared about you very much."
Cinder gasped.
"Jason!"
Shaking his head, he snatched the port screen back from the woman.
"I'll start looking," he said, shouldering past Cinder. "Why don't you ask her what happened next?"
Cinder glared at his back until he disappeared down one of the rows.
"Sorry about that," she said, searching for some excuse. "He's, you know, also Lunar." "He is one of hers."
Cinder turned back to the woman, who looked offended at Jason's words.
"Not anymore."
Grunting, the woman turned to reposition the fan so Cinder could catch most of the gentle breeze.
"Courage comes in many forms. You know about that."
Pride flickered over the woman's face.
"I guess so." "Perhaps your friend was brave enough to join her guard. My son was brave enough not to."
Rubbing absently at her wrist, Cinder leaned against the counter.
"Did something happen? Afterward?" "Of course."
There was still pride on her face, but also anger, and also sadness.
3 days after my son died, 2 men came to our house. They took my husband out into the street and forced him to beg the queen's forgiveness for raising such a disloyal child. And then they killed him anyway as punishment, and as a warning to any other conscripts who were thinking of disobeying the crown."
Her eyes were beginning to water, but she held on to a pained smile.
"It took me almost 4 years to find a ship that was coming to Earth and willing to accept me as a stowaway. 4 years of pretending that I didn't hate her, of pretending to be one more loyal citizen."
Cinder gulped.
"I'm so sorry."
Reaching forward, the woman cupped Cinder's cheek.
"Thank you for defying her in a way that I never could."
Her voice turned to steel.
"I hope you kill her,"
Do you carry fentanyl 10? Asked Jason, returning to the counter and dropping three small boxes onto it. Pressing her lips, the woman took the port screen out of his hand.
I will do this,
she said, slipping around the counter and heading toward the front corner of the store. That's what I thought, he muttered. Cinder propped her chin on her metal fist, eyeing him. I never realized Royal Guard was a mandatory position. Not for everyone. A lot of people want to be chosen. It's a big honor on Luna. Did you? He slid his gaze to her. Nah, I always wanted to be a doctor. His tone was thick with sarcasm, and yet Cinder's optobionics didn't peg it as a lie. She crossed her arms. So, who were you protecting?
What do you mean?
Something scraped against the floor, the shopkeeper shoving around dusty bins. When you were conscripted to be a royal guard, who would Lavanna have murdered if you'd refused? His pale eyes frosted over. Reaching past the counter, he angled the fan toward himself.
Doesn't matter. They're probably going to end up dead anyway.
Cinder looked away. Because he'd chosen to join her side, his loved ones could suffer. Maybe not, she said. Lavanna doesn't know that you betrayed her yet. She could think I glamored you, that I'm forcing you to help us.
And you think that will make a difference?
It might, she watched as the shopkeeper dug through a bin. A fly buzzed near her head, and Cinder batted it away. So, how does one get chosen to be a royal guard anyway?
There are certain traits they look for.
And loyalty isn't one of them?
Why would it be? She can fake loyalty. It's like with your special op friend. He would have shown fast reflexes, good instincts, and some amount of common sense. Match him up with a thaumaturge who can turn him into a wild animal, and it no longer matters what he thinks or wants. He just does what he's told.
I've seen Wolf fight it, Cinder said, feeling compelled to defend him now that Scarlet wasn't here to do it. The first time Cinder had seen Wolf, he'd been covered in blood and crouched threateningly over Scarlet, although Scarlet had always insisted that he wouldn't have hurt her, that he was different from the others, stronger. Of course, that was before Wolf had gotten himself shot, taking a bullet for a thaumaturge, moments before Scarlet was kidnapped. It's obviously not easy to do, she amended, but it is possible for them to fight against the mind control.
Lots of good that seems to have done him.
Locking her jaw, Cinder pressed her metal hand against the back of her neck, letting it cool her down. He'd rather fight and lose than become another one of her pawns. We all would.
Good for you. Not everyone's given that option.
She noticed that his hand had settled comfortably on the knife sheathed against his thigh. Clearly, Lavanna didn't want you for your chattiness. So what were the traits you possessed that made her think you'd be a good guard? That look of smug amusement returned, like he was letting her in on a private joke.
My pretty face, he said. Can't you tell?
She snorted. You're starting to sound like Thorn. She stumbled over his name. Thorn, who would never make jokes about his own charisma again. Jason didn't seem to notice.
It's sad, but true.
Cinder swallowed her sudden remorse. Lavanna chooses her personal guards based on who makes the best wall decorations? I'm suddenly feeling better about our chances.
That and our very weak minds.
You're kidding?
Nope.
If I'd been good with my gift, I might have made thaumaturge, but the queen wants her guards to be easily controlled. We're like puppets for her to shuffle around. After all, if we show the slightest resistance to being controlled, it could mean the difference between life and death for Her Majesty. Cinder thought of the ball, when she'd had the gun and had tried to shoot Lavanna. The red-haired guard had jumped in front of the bullet without hesitation. She'd always assumed he'd been doing his duty to protect the queen, that he'd done it willingly. But now, she recognized how his movements were too jerky, too unnatural, and how the queen hadn't even flinched.
She'd been controlling him. Jason was right. He'd acted just like a puppet.
But you were able to resist control on the ship.
Because Thaumaturge Mira was preoccupied with your operative. Otherwise, I would have been the same brainless mannequin that I usually am.
His tone was self-deprecating, but Cinder could detect bitterness beneath it. Nobody liked to be controlled, and she didn't think anyone ever got used to it.
And you don't think they suspected that you're
a traitor? If that's what you are.
His thumb traced around the knife handle.
My gift is pretty much worthless. I couldn't even control an earthen, much less a skilled lunar. I could never do what you do. But I've gotten pretty good at keeping my thoughts empty when the Queen or Thaumaturge is around. To them, I have about as much brains and willpower as a tree stump. Not exactly threatening.
Near the front of the store, the woman started humming to herself as she scavenged for Cinder's supplies.
You're doing it right now, aren't you? Said Cinder, crossing her arms. Keeping your thoughts empty?
It's a habit.
Closing her eyes, Cinder felt around for him with her thoughts. His presence was there, but just barely. She knew that she could have controlled him without any effort at all, but the energy rolling off his body didn't give anything away. No emotions, no opinions. He simply melted into the background.
Huh. I always thought your training must have taught you that.
Just healthy self-preservation.
Furrowing her brow, she opened her eyes again. The man before her was an emotional black hole, according to her lunar gift. But if he could fool Levana...
She narrowed her eyes. Lie to me.
What?
Tell me a lie. It doesn't have to be a big one.
He was silent for a long time, and she imagined she could hear him sifting through all the lies and truths, weighing them against each other. Finally, he said,
Levana's not so bad once you get to know her.
An orange light blinked on in the corner of her vision. At Jason's mocking grin, Cinder started to laugh, the tension rising off her shoulders like heat waves off the desert sand. At least her cyborg programming could still tell her whether or not he was lying to her, which meant he hadn't been lying when he'd said he was loyal to his princess, and his princess alone. The shopkeeper returned and dumped an armful of different drugs on the counter, scanned the port screen, whistled, then drifted away again.
Now that you know all about me, said Jason, as if it were anywhere close to true, I have a question for you.
Go for it, she said, organizing the bottles into neat rows. My secrets are mostly public knowledge these days.
I may be able to hide my emotions from the Queen, but I can't hide the fact that I'm lunar. And that I can be controlled by her.
But when you first came to that ball, your gift seemed non-existent.
Honestly, I thought you were earthen at first, and I know that's why the Queen and Thaumaturge Mira were taunting you, treating you like a shell, which you might as well have been for how powerless you were.
He stared at Cinder, as if trying to see into the mess of wires and chips in her head.
Then, suddenly, you weren't powerless anymore. Your gift was practically blinding, maybe even worse than Levana's.
Gee, thanks, Cinder muttered.
So, how did you do it? How could you hide that much power? Levana should have known immediately. We all should have known. Now when I look at you, it's practically all I see.
Biting her lip, Cinder glanced toward the mirror over the shop's small sink. She caught her reflection and wasn't surprised to find a smudge of dirt on her jaw. How long had it been there? And strands of hair falling messily out of her ponytail. True to form, the mirror showed her just as she had always been. Plain, dirty, a cyborg. She tried to imagine what it would be like to see herself as she saw Levana. Frighteningly gorgeous and powerful. But it was impossible with that reflection staring back at her. That was why Levana despised mirrors so much. But Cinder found her reflection almost comforting. The shopkeeper called her brave and beautiful. Jason called her blinding. It was kind of nice to know that they were both wrong. She was still just Cinder.
Tucking a strand of hair behind her ear,
She tried her best to explain to Jason the bioelectrical security system her adoptive father had invented and installed on her spinal cord. For years, it had prevented her from using her gift, which was why, until recently, she hadn't known she was lunar at all. The device was meant to protect her, not only by preventing her from using her gift so that Earthans wouldn't know what she was, but also to prevent the side effects that most lunars experienced when they didn't use their gift for long periods of time. Side effects of delusions and depressions and madness. That's why you might overhear Dr. Erland babbling to himself sometimes, she said. He didn't use the gift for years after coming to Earth, and now his sanity is... Wait. She paused, not only because Jason had spoken, but because something had changed in the air around him. A sudden spike of emotion, catching Cinder off guard. This device kept you from losing your mental stability, even though you weren't using your gift for years. Well, it kept me from using my gift in the first place, and also protected me from those side effects. He turned his face away from her and took a minute to school his features back into nonchalance, but it was too late. There was a new intensity behind his eyes as he grasped the implications. A device that could take away a person's lunar gift would make them all equal. Anyway, said Cinder, rubbing the back of her neck where the device was still installed, though now broken. Dr. Erland disabled it. My gift had been coming and going for a couple of weeks before the ball, but then all the emotional stress overwhelmed my system and the device, and there I was, fully lunar. Not a moment too soon. She cringed, recalling the sensation of a gun pressed against her temple. Do any more of these devices exist? He said, his eyes strangely bright. I don't think so. My stepfather died before it was fully tested, and as far as I know, he didn't manufacture any others. Although he may have left behind some plans or blueprints that explain how it works. Doesn't seem possible. An invention like that, it could change everything. He shook his head, staring into space as the shopkeeper returned and set a basket full of supplies on the counter. She grabbed the bottles from before and threw them on top, along with Cinder's port screen. This is perfect, said Cinder, pulling the basket toward her. Thank you so much. The doctor said you could put it on his tab? No payment from Cinder Lynn, said the woman, waving one hand while she pulled a port screen out of her apron pocket. But may I take your picture for my net profile, my first celebrity? Cinder flinched away from her. I'm sorry, I'm not really doing the picture thing these days. The woman wilted in disappointment, tucking her port back into her pocket. Sorry, really. I'll talk to the doctor about paying you, all right? She hauled the basket off the counter without waiting to hear another argument. Not doing pictures these days? Jason muttered as they hurried through the shop. How very lunar of you. Cinder glared against the sudden burning sunlight. Very wanted criminal of me, too,